You're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMM LP, Burlington, Vermont. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and this is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. Write the Book features interviews with authors, poets, illustrators, agents, and editors. And today on Write the Book, you're going to hear two interviews, the first with Chris Bojalian, and then the second with the author Sue William Silverman. But my first interview today is with Lincoln, Vermont author Chris Bojalian, the critically acclaimed author of 17 books, including 9 New York Times bestsellers. His work has been translated into over 25 languages and 3 times become movies. His books have been chosen as best books of the year by the Washington Post, the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, the Hartford Courant, Publishers Weekly, Library Journal, Carcass Reviews, Book Page, and Salon. His awards include the ANCA Freedom Award for his work educating Americans about the Armenian Genocide, the ANCA Arts and Letters Award for the Sandcastle Girls, as well as the St. Mesrub Mashdot Medal, the New England Society Book Award for The Night Strangers, the New England Book Award, a Boston Public Library Literary Light, a finalist for the Lambda Literary Award, and the Anahid Literary Award. His novel Midwives was a number one New York Times bestseller, a selection of Oprah's Book Club, and a New England Booksellers Association Discovery pick. He is a fellow of the Vermont Academy of Arts and Sciences. Chris Bojalian's novel, The Light in the Ruins, a reimagining of Romeo and Juliet set in Tuscany at the end of the Second World War, debuted as a New York Times Publishers Weekly and National IndieBound bestseller. He has written for a wide variety of magazines and newspapers, including The Washington Post, Cosmopolitan, Reader's Digest, and the Boston Globe Sunday Magazine. He has been a weekly columnist in Vermont for the Burlington Free Press since February of 1992. Chris Bojalian graduated Phi Beta Kappa and summa cum laude from Amherst College and lives in Vermont with his wife, the photographer Victoria Bluer, and their daughter, Grace Experience. I spoke with Chris last week by phone, and we discussed his new book, Close Your Eyes, Hold Hands, which comes out tomorrow, July 8th. Close Your Eyes, Hold Hands is the story of Emily Shepard, a homeless teen living in an igloo made of ice and trash bags filled with frozen leaves. Half a year earlier, a nuclear plant in Vermont's Northeast Kingdom experienced a cataclysmic meltdown, and both of Emily's parents were killed. Devastatingly, her father was in charge of the plant, and the meltdown may have been his fault. Was he drunk when it happened? Thousands of people are forced to flee their homes in the kingdom. Rivers and forests are destroyed, and Emily feels certain that as the daughter of the most hated man in America, she is in danger. So instead of following the social workers and her classmates after the meltdown, Emily takes off on her own for Burlington, where she survives by stealing, sleeping on the floor of a drug dealer's apartment, and inventing a new identity for herself, an identity inspired by her favorite poet, Emily Dickinson. When Emily befriends a young homeless boy named Cameron, she protects him with a ferocity she didn't know she had. But she still can't outrun her past, can't escape her grief, can't hide forever. And so she comes up with the only plan that she can. When I spoke to Chris Bojalian last week, I began by asking him how he came to write Close Your Eyes, Hold Hands.
I'm a big fan of Spectrum Youth and Family Services in Burlington, Vermont, and the great work they do with teens in trouble. As a matter of fact, I went to college with Annie Ramnisiano. She recently resigned from Spectrum, but she must have been there 17 or 18 years. We were having lunch together in Burlington, Vermont, and she started telling me stories about some of the kids who had built igloos made of trash bags filled with frozen leaves against the cold on the Lake Champlain waterfront. Mm. Over the years, I've written about a lot of Spectrum kids for the Burlington Free Press. And I knew instantly when Annie told me that story that I wanted to write a novel about a girl trying desperately to survive in a quasi-post-apocalyptic world in one of those igloos.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit about your narrator. Your narrator is Emily Shepard. She's the daughter of an important employee in the fictional nuclear power plant in the Northeast Kingdom called Cape Abenaki. And Cape Abenaki has an accident, and her father comes to be blamed by the media and the public at large. So I wondered if you could talk a little bit about writing from Emily's narrative point of view to start.
Sometimes my books demand a lot of research.
Uh-huh.
Not close your eyes, hold hands. Emily's voice came to me almost alchemically. It was December 28th, 2012, and I was thinking about that igloo, and I was thinking about the stories that I'd heard over the years, and I knew instantly who Emily Shepherd was. Now, my daughter, Grace, she's 20.
Uh-huh.
When she read a rough draft of Close Your Eyes, Hold Hands, she said to me the following, and it is so astute and so spot on. She said, "Dad, take this as a compliment, because I mean it that way, but I think your sweet spot as a novelist is seriously messed up young women." And I knew exactly what she meant. Think of the narrators from some of my better books. Connie Danforth in Midwives, Serafina Bettini in The Light and Ruins, Laurel Esterbrook in The Double Bind, and certainly Hatun, Nivart, and Carine in The Sandcastle Girls.
Mm-hmm.
When I am at my best, I am writing about emotionally scarred, sometimes physically scarred young women, and how, against all odds, they are striving mightily to keep it together.
Yeah, I totally see that in a lot of your works. I wondered, as I was reading Close Your Eyes, Hold Hands, as the author, as you were working, did you mostly see this as Emily's story, or did you mostly see this as a story about Vermont and a possible nuclear meltdown?
It's a lovely question. I thought about this always, entirely and completely, as Emily Shepherd's story. The nuclear meltdown wasn't even in my mind for the book when I was writing the opening scenes of Emily and her igloo down on the Burlington waterfront. The meltdown would come later in my mind. I was trying to have a reason for Emily to be on the streets and still to be recognizable as someone who could be the daughter of one of my readers, someone who could be one of my readers herself. And that meant a reason for her life being such an unbelievable, cataclysmic disaster.
Mm-hmm.
And the role of that fell to a fictional nuclear power plant in Vermont's Northeast Kingdom. And the reason why the nuclear power plant in the novel is set in the Northeast Kingdom is because I wanted it to be an absolute disaster, but not a disaster that affected hundreds of thousands of people.
Mm-hmm.
The exclusion zone in my novel is actually smaller, by far, than the exclusion zone right now around Fukushima.
Mm-hmm.
And when we think of Japan, we don't think of it as a post-apocalyptic country. And so one of the ironies to this book for Emily is that she's living in an igloo made of trash bags filled with frozen leaves down on the waterfront, but at times she ruminates upon the reality that 6 months after the meltdown, are people in Los Angeles even thinking about this? Good gracious, 4 months after the meltdown, there are people skiing in southwestern Vermont.
Yeah.
Not 4 months, forgive me, 5 or 6 months. But, you know, the following ski season, there are people skiing in southern Vermont.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, I found myself wondering as I read it if you drew on your experience of 9/11 as you wrote about the moments after the meltdown.
That's a great question. I must confess, not consciously.
Okay.
Not consciously at all. When 9/11 occurred, I was on a book tour for Transistor Radio, and I would spend about a week stranded in a hotel room in Denver, unable to get home, far from my family, far from my wife, who, of course, had worked on the 104th floor of the World Trade Towers when she'd been younger. There might have been some unconscious or subconscious connections, but they weren't conscious.
Yeah. Okay. Did you interview anybody who had been through anything like this, or did you mostly just draw on news stories and your own interpretation of what it must be like?
You know, I certainly have spoken to enough teens in trouble over the years. When I go to my blog, for example, which concludes my Burlington Free Press columns, if I search the word spectrum, immediately 8 articles come up.
Right, right.
So I didn't do subsequent research with a lot of kids. I spent a lot of time talking to Annie Ramnisiana,
uh-huh.
that therapist I mentioned earlier, she was one of my early readers. She read the entire first draft of the book and was able to be really smart and insightful about what was working and what wasn't working, what was authentic and what was not authentic. And I also need to give a really, really big shout-out to Arne Gunderson and Maggie Gunderson of Fairwinds Energy Education. They taught me so much about nuclear power and about nuclear plants. And I also think I need to give a shout-out in terms of the voice of Emily Shepard to my daughter, Grace. Grace is a young actor. She lives in New York City. And I must have texted her almost every day I was writing this novel, because I would be striking out on Urban Dictionary when I was searching for the right word. So I would send her a text and I would say, okay, I need hipster slang for hookup, or I need hipster speak for wasted. And she would instantly text me back five or six perfect words. I mean, my new favorite word is bitch cakes. And you would not have you would not have found bitch cakes in my novel if it hadn't been Grace who taught me it.
Okay, great.
Incidentally, she read the audio of Close Your Eyes, Hold Hands for Random House Audiobooks.
Oh, awesome. That's wonderful. Yeah, that would be perfect because she's an actor and I'm sure she can do this character very well. So, you know, I found myself drawn into the book from the very start, and I was interested to see the way you told the story. And I wondered if it was at all a challenge for you to find the beginning of this story and to let it unfold in a way that was both easy to follow and also held suspense, which I felt like it did those two things very well.
I depend upon my characters to take me by the hand and lead me through the dark of the story. I never have an outline. I might be 75,000 words into a book before I understand what it's really about and how it will end. That means, of course, that I do a lot of rewriting, a lot of drafts. But I think it was Gabriel Garcia Marquez who said, the only reason writers publish is to stop rewriting. I began with the igloo and just began to try to carve out Emily's life on the streets that horrific winter after she's so alone on the Burlington waterfront. Once I understood the role of the meltdown and the role of the nuclear power plants, I went back to the beginning and rewrote with that in mind. But I always began with the igloo, and for me the touchstone of the book will always be the igloo.
Within the narrative itself, Emily sometimes deviates, and she offers small asides. These asides are actually delineated by dotted lines on the page. They're removed from the rest of the text. And so here's an example on page 66 of my copy of the book. She says, "I seem to be jumping around a lot. This is supposed to be the BC section of my story, before Cameron. I should probably try and organize my thoughts." So I have two questions about this. First of all, she directly addresses the reader in these moments, and I wondered if you could talk about these asides. And also then there is this character named Cameron. I wondered if you could talk about his role in the novel a little bit.
Sure, I'll address the first question first. Emily Shepard is a young writer. She's 16 years old. She's an OxyContin addict on the street. She's a cutter, and she's an aspiring poet who adores Emily Dickinson. One of the epigraphs for the novel is Emily Dickinson's quote, "Tell all the truth, but tell it slant." And that's how Emily tells her story. She's writing in journals, and she's telling it as best she can. But just like Emily Dickinson, there is a decided edge to her story, a decided edge to her words. And I don't think you can see that any better than in the title she chooses for her memoir, Close Your Eyes, Hold Hands. She tells us at one point that it sounds like a Hallmark greeting card, two people holding hands on a beautiful August afternoon as they jump off a dock into a pond. But as she will reveal, the origin of that couplet, like Emily's story, is far darker. Now, she might jump around a lot, and she acknowledges that she does, but there is a method to her madness, or at least she's really responsible to her reader. I know at one point she can't remember on page 6 or 7 what a special kind of window is on a wood stove, and she promises the reader she'll look it up.
Mm-hmm.
And about 70 pages later, she does. She tells the reader, you know, it's a Palladian window. I told you I'd look it up. That's what I love about her story. Now, because she jumps around, I think it heightens the dread,
mm-hmm.
which brings me to Cameron. Cameron is a 9-year-old foster child who runs away from the most recent horrific foster home environment. And Emily takes him under her wing, and he lives with her in the igloo down by the waterfront, and she does the best that she can by him, even if she knows she's making globally a horrifically bad parenting decision. But she really does her best by him, and he, in some ways, gives her a will to live that is just about gone. When she finds Cameron, or when Cameron finds her, she's at the end of her tether. But his presence in her life energizes her. It gives her another reason to try to put one foot in front of the other and soldier on. And because of how she tells her story, there's an ominousness that hangs over her relationship with Cameron almost from the moment they meet.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It was a wonderful relationship and it added so much tension to a book that already had a lot of suspense, but it gave this other personal storyline that was really very poignant. I wanted to ask you, you mentioned Emily Dickinson. I wanted to ask you, as a writer, and a lot of the listeners are writers, can you talk a little bit about the legal use of poetry and song lyrics? Writers need to be careful, don't they, in including these in their books?
Yes, absolutely. Yes. So, for example, in the case of Emily Dickinson, most of the poems in there are in the public domain.
Okay.
But not all, because some of Emily Dickinson's poems were published so long after her death that the copyright has not yet expired. So I did pay for the use of some of the poems by Emily Dickinson that appear in the book.
Okay.
There's a second issue called fair use. You can quote, and I don't remember whether it's 6 words or 8 words or 10 words, but there's a certain number of words you can use that is considered fair use without having to pay for it.
Uh-huh. Okay, that's great. Your books often tell a personal story that takes place within a larger historical context, and actually that might be a fictional historical context, as is the case with Close Your Eyes, Hold Hands. Sometimes this larger context involves a controversial subject, such as nuclear power, or midwifery, or homeopathy. So I'm wondering if you can talk about the pros and cons of addressing controversial subjects in your fiction, and any advice for writers who tackle controversial issues.
Oh, I think it's great. I think it's always great to tackle a controversial issue.
Mm-hmm.
John Gardner, great teacher of writing, mm-hmm. as well as a great short story writer himself, said the two points of a compass that matter most in fiction are conflict and human transformation. And in issues usually controversial because there's conflict. So when you're writing about a controversy, not only are you giving yourself the great gift of literary conflict, but you're giving your characters an opportunity to change and to grow.
Mm-hmm.
Now, does that mean that there won't be people who fundamentally dislike the book because they don't approach it as a piece of literature, but instead approach it as a polemic? Sure. But the interesting thing about, for example, my novel, Before You Know Kindness, about an animal rights activist, is how many people asked me whether I was a vegetarian after reading that book, because they wanted to be vegetarians after reading it, but they weren't sure how I felt about that, because the animal rights activist is not especially likable.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I am a vegetarian. I am an animal rights activist. But my point in writing that book wasn't to write a 135,000-word polemic. No one wants to read a 135,000-word polemic. My goal was to tell a really interesting story about one character and one family's transformation.
Right. Now that book also deals with gun laws, does it not? Am I remembering that correctly?
You are remembering correctly. It does revolve a bit around guns, and because the book begins with a 12-year-old girl crippling her father for life when she shoots him in the shoulder with her father's hunting rifle.
Okay.
But again, I personally view that more as a book about animal rights than about guns.
Okay, great. I wondered if you've started your next project yet and if it's anything that you care to talk about.
I have started my next project, but I have no idea if it's any good. It seems to have a very, very long way to go. It's about two young women who are abducted from Volgograd and Yerevan, brought to the United States as sex slaves, and the bachelor party where everything goes to hell in a handbasket, and two people are dead.
Wow. Okay. So there's a controversial subject and a personal story. Wow, that sounds very intense. Okay. And then finally, Chris, I'm wondering if you've read anything lately that you would recommend to listeners, any books that you've read that you've enjoyed?
Oh, gosh. Yeah. You know, okay, first of all, this is a book that has flown under the radar, but it's so lovely. Ellen Littman's, L-I-T-M-A-N, Ellen Littman's Mannequin Girl.
Oh,
Mannequin Girl is the story of a girl coming of age with scoliosis in Gorbachev, Russia. It's haunting, it's beautiful, it's funny, and it's so beautifully written. So I could highly recommend Mannequin Girl. There are two new paperbacks coming out in July of books that I read last year that I liked very, very much. Scariest book I read in a long time, John Searle's Help for the Haunted. You will never go into your basement again at nighttime after reading that book. And a book by my great friend Stephen Kiernan, The Curiosity. That's about to come out in paperback. It's one of those beautiful, beautiful love stories. It's also science fiction about a brilliant judge from the 19th century who is essentially reanimated in the 21st.
Ooh, okay. What's that called again?
The Curiosity.
Okay, wonderful. Well, it is always such a pleasure to speak with you, Chris, and I thank you so much for your time today. The book, again, is Close Your Eyes, Hold Hands, published by Doubleday on July 8th.
Sure, it's always great to speak with you, and I hope we get to chat again about your novel when it comes out later this year.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Thank you.
I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Chris Bojalian. You can learn more about his work at his website, chrisbojalian.com, and his last name is spelled B-O-H-J-A-L-I-A-N. Chris will be at the Fletcher Free Library tonight at 7 for the start of his new book tour. I'll mention that again later during our Bookworms calendar. My second interview today is with the author Sue William Silverman, whose new book is The Pat Boone Fan Club, My Life as a White Anglo-Saxon Jew. Sue William Silverman is the author of two memoirs, Because I Remember Terror, Father, I Remember You, which won the Association of Writers and Writing Programs Award Series in Creative Nonfiction. Her memoir, Lovesick, One Woman's Journey Through Sexual Addiction, was made into a Lifetime TV original movie. Her poetry collection is Hieroglyphics in Neon. When I last spoke to her on the show, we discussed her craft book, Fearless Confessions, A Writer's Guide to Memoir. Sue William Silverman teaches in the Low Residency MFA in Writing program at the Vermont College of Fine Arts. This time we discussed her new book, The Pat Boone Fan Club, My Life as a White Anglo-Saxon Jew. Here's a brief summary of the book. Gentile reader, and you, Jews, come too. Follow Sue William Silverman, a one-woman cultural mashup, on her exploration of identity among the mishmash of American idols and ideals that confuse most of us, or should. Pat Boone is our first stop. Now a Tea Party activist, Boone, once shown as a squeaky clean pop music icon of normality, an antidote for Silverman's own confusing and dangerous home, where being a Jew in a Christian school wasn't easy, and being the daughter of the anti-Boone was unspeakable. And yet somehow Silverman found her way, a gefilte fish swimming upstream, and found her voice, which in this searching, bracing, hilarious and moving book tries to make sense of that most troubling American condition, belonging, but to what? When I spoke with Sue, I began by asking her about the tone of her new book, which is more ironic and humorous than her previous books, although this one also tackles serious subjects, such as searching for identity in a world in which she felt very much like an outsider.
Well, I think with the first two memoirs, it's true, they were dark. The first one was about, you know, growing up in an incestuous family. The second one was recovering from sex addiction. And to some extent, I think it's a matter of sort of pushing yourself as an artist, as a writer, that I do have other voices, different ways of expressing myself, and I've sort of done the dark things. And to just sort of keep writing in that same voice almost would be, I hate to use the word boring, but kind of boring. And I think, you know, when we're told as writers to find your voice, that I think is very misleading, because really what one wants to do is find the voice of the piece. And if you're writing about sort of growing up wanting Pat Boone to be your father, and Pat Boone is, you know, very religious, conservative, Republican, and I happen to be a Jewish atheist, liberal Democrat, obviously that has to be sort of ironic. I mean, there's no way you can sort of go just straight with that. At the same time, you know, I really did sincerely want him to be my father, so I think that there's that kind of conflict within the book is important to sort of note, but there, so that it can be both ironic and yet I write as a narrator who's sort of yearning for self-identity and you know, for a safe father.
Yeah, yeah. I think also the fact that he is who he is lends itself really well to that kind of conflict that you're talking about, because in a way he's almost like he's this untouchable star who isn't, he doesn't seem very real, right?
Yeah, I mean, he doesn't seem real. I mean, he's has this sort of this Pat Boone persona, and you know, back in the 50s and 60s he was a famous pop singer, and now I can't really say that he seems sort of trapped in that time. And that, so when I did see him rather recently, he's still trying to be kind of the Pat Boone, and it's both sort of sad and touching.
Yeah.
But also just the fact that he could see me and hear me. I mean, he's read the book. He really likes it. And, you know, I was just out in L.A. I attended his 80th birthday celebrity roast birthday party. And he'd already read the book. And I saw him and, you know, he hugged me and gave me a kiss on the cheek. But then we were actually talking about the last line of the book is sort of metaphoric. And we were talking about metaphor, so here we are. I mean, he's also just really smart and intelligent. And he's just a contradiction in so many ways. But in a way, that makes it better to write about him. Because, yes, he does give off this sort of plastic persona. But when you stay with him, he is deeper than that.
Sure.
He'll maybe sort of let his guard down, sort of one-on-one.
Yeah. How many times have you met him?
So first time was just when I was a little teeny bopper living in New Jersey, and he had a live television show, and I got a ticket, and I went to see his show. So basically, that was just, I gave him this book to be autographed, and he had written this book to 12 and 20. So you can count that, because that is when it started, but I didn't even speak to him. I was, like, so freaked out. But then as an adult, I've now seen him three times. You know, the first time after this concert that was, like, in 2005, and that's what's made this whole book sort of kick-started the whole book into being, was that I did go to this concert a few years ago, and just because I'd had a crush on him all these years, I realized he was going to be 20 minutes from my house. I got a ticket, I went, and afterwards I just barged backstage and sort of threw myself at him and told him, you know, how he'd been this father figure to me growing up and everything, and he was sort of looked a little scared, like, who is this woman? But he was also very gracious. And then I'd given him a letter to read that explained in more detail. And then I did write this, what became the first essay in the book called The Papoon Fan Club, that somehow he managed to find in this literary journal. His best friend saw it and sent it to him, and I got an email from Pat Boone, and he thanked me for writing it. And then he said he was going to be back in Michigan, which is where I live, and he invited me to his Christmas concert, and he sort of officially invited me backstage to have like a real conversation with him, as opposed to the first time when I just barged in. So I did, so I went backstage afterwards, and he sat down with me, and I mean, he was so sweet. I was wearing this jacket that had this like embroidered flower on it, and he'd read my first two memoirs, and so he sort of pointed to the flower, and he said, "You remind me of a flower growing up through concrete." And like, he really saw me like as a father should, but as my own real father never did see me.
Yeah.
So I mean, it really, you know, he can see me.
Yeah.
And that's just so amazing to me, you know, to go from this little teeny bopper high school crush or junior high school crush to like now he knows who I am and he's reading my books. It's just, it's amazing.
It's very cool.
It is very cool.
Very cool.
I know.
I found it interesting that despite eventually having something of a friendship with him or a correspondence and seeing him these times and in writing these essays, you always refer to him by his full name, Pat Boone, every single time. You never just call him Pat or Mr. Boone. So this was a choice that you made. Can you talk about that choice?
Yeah. To me, he really is that, still that Pat Boone star.
Right.
I mean, just call him Pat suggests that we have a very close friendship, which we do not, really. And Mr. Boone sounds formal, and that's not who he is. He is Pat Boone.
Yeah.
You know, it's like that celebrity persona is Pat Boone.
Right.
And I just can't think of him in any other way. I mean, actually, when I saw him in person just recently at this birthday party, I did call him Pat because it just seemed too weird to call him, "Hey, Pat Boone." But in writing the book, definitely it was Pat Boone.
Right, right. Okay, I enjoyed that. And, you know, actually, now that you're saying that, it makes sense in another way, too, because neither Pat nor Mr. Boone fits being a father figure.
Right.
Whereas Pat Boone, the icon who was just a father figure by virtue of being a star, that works.
Exactly.
Exactly. Yeah. Okay. So let's talk a little bit about the structure of the book, which is something else that was a little bit different. Each chapter feels like a unique, separate entity. And you just mentioned that they were essays, which I suspect is the answer to this question. Some of them read kind of like straight narratives that readers might sort of feel more used to. And then some are very different. Like in several places through the book, you present chapters that offer guidance to your gentle or Gentile, sometimes reader, in the form of a letter from a narrator who seems to be gefilte fish.
Right. Strange as that may sound.
So, right. So this is unusual structurally. I mean, there are other things that I'm going to ask you about later structurally, but let's talk about those letters. How did you come to that?
Ironically, the letters were the very last thing that I wrote for the book. So I had these. At first, I mean, I didn't even know I was writing a book. I was just sort of writing kind of what I thought were standalone essays. And I've been working on the project for about a year when I realized, oh, I seem to be exploring my relationship to Judaism. How interesting. And I did not know that I was doing that. And so what I did then is I basically revised most of the essays. Some I didn't have to, but I revised a lot of the essays to more clearly fit that theme so that they, yeah, they had been standalone, they had been published, but I made them, rewrote them to more clearly fit the theme of the book. But then after all of those essays were collected into this one book, I still felt that I needed a kind of through thread that would hold all of these essays together. And those came out in the sort of that epistolary, you know, sort of 18th century or whatever form of dear reader. So I could really kind of present to the reader, well, this is really what I'm struggling with, you know, that I am struggling with my identity and I don't know who I am and I'm trying to find out who I am. And the gefilte fish metaphor came to me because a gefilte fish, for those of you who do not know, isn't really a fish. It's just this sort of conglomerate of fish parts from all sorts of fish just kind of put together into this thing. So a gefilte fish doesn't have an identity either. So I started totally identifying with this gefilte fish. Listen, I know how surreal it sounds.
I love that, though.
I mean, it just sounds so weird. But it seemed to work. So I guess there are about four or five of those dear reader sections sprinkled throughout the whole book to kind of give it that idea of being a real thematically cohesive collection of essays.
Okay. Now, to what extent when you were growing up were you an affiliated Jew, a practicing Jew?
Hardly at all. I mean, when I lived in the West Indies, we did go to synagogue some Saturdays, not real often, but some Saturdays. But I knew nothing about the religion. When I did go to the temple, I didn't feel anything. It was just, you know, there I am. And as I write in one of the essays, the temple in the West Indies in St. Thomas had sand on the floor. And I used to just basically sit on the floor and play with the sand. So that's how religious I am. And, I mean, I really always did kind of want to be Christian.
Yeah.
And I, various times, I had a rosary. Most of my friends, were Christian. My two ex-husbands are both Christians. Not that they're practicing either, but they were born Christian. And I have never joined a temple or synagogue. And it just, now where I'm at, I do feel more Jewish, but not in a religious way. It's more in a way of identifying with a kind of culture. Mm-hmm. And certainly, I believe in the state of Israel, so I'm a Zionist, in that sense.
Yeah.
But the religious aspects, they just don't really speak to me. I mean, I just don't know how to feel that.
And it's interesting because being raised without the religious aspects, of course, that wouldn't be something that you identify with. And yet, every Jew who is known to be Jewish will be identified by other people as Jewish.
Absolutely.
And probably still, but certainly then.
Absolutely. I mean, everybody who knows me would say, what religion is Sue? They would say, oh, she's Jewish.
Right.
Absolutely. I mean, when you're sort of other and you're not part of the dominant culture or religion, that's how people see me.
Right.
Absolutely.
Right.
Or all of us. Yeah.
Now, you did live in Israel for a while.
Yes, I worked on the kibbutz.
Mm-hmm. And I remember that was a great essay because it was sort of like the first time that you felt like you fit in, and that was such a lovely piece. Actually, there were a few pieces, but the one piece that was very short, I'm wondering, actually, you want to read that one real quick?
So this is really the shortest essay in the piece, and the title is For Jews Only. Teenage boys dive bomb into the pool, spraying water, or they sneak behind girls, grab them, and toss them in. Girls' voices shriek in mock anger, but I can tell they like being singled out, noticed. I dab copper tone on my nose and shoulders. Humidity frizzes my dark auburn hair. Here, I look like the other girls. They look like me. Is this why no one talks to me, notices me? I don't stand out. In the distance, men in caps stroll the golf course. Women play mahjong, a Chinese game. Men play a Scottish game. I slide into the water and lie on my back, barely bobbing on the surface. The mahjong words sound like a meditation, a poem, a chant. Women wearing straw hats and sunglasses sit beside the swimming pool on patio furniture, speaking exotic words as they play. Tiles click. Plum, orchard, chrysanthemum, bamboo, dragon tiles, season tiles, honor tiles, prevailing winds, east winds, west winds. Sun warms my face. Water cools my back. I am at the Westwood Country Club in Bergen County, New Jersey. But I could be in Shanghai. I could be Chinese. So there, basically, it's that setting, of course, is a Jewish country club for Jews only. And in a way, I both fit in there. But realize, still, I could be anywhere. I mean, I could be in China, because just growing up, I really could kind of glom on to any identity or any religion or any country, just searching for this, who am I?
Right, right.
Because I didn't feel Jewish, and because my father sexually molested me, I didn't feel part of that family. So I always felt like, well, I'm up for adoption,
Yeah.
And I use the word adoption very loosely in that it could be by a family, a country, a religion, anything.
Pat Boone,
absolutely. Oh, yes. I mean, that's the whole point, was I wanted Pat Boone to adopt me. And alas, he never did. But at the same time, as I said earlier, I think ultimately he did kind of see me as a daughter. And he, by him seeing me as a daughter, I could see him as kind of the good, safe father that I always thought that he was.
Yeah, and what a wonderful thing that he, upon your initially kind of blundering backstage and trying in a bit of a nervous rush to explain yourself, that he didn't just turn his back and walk away and say, this lady.
Yeah, he's nuts. Yeah. No, he never turned away. That's the thing. I barged backstage. He listened to me. He accepted my letter. He wrote to me after I'd published the first essay. He invited me backstage. I mean, he just is a lovely, lovely man.
Yeah.
And that's what makes him interesting because, yes, he does have this very strident sort of right-wing conservative leaning where he can be really outspoken in ways that I would just don't believe or agree with him on any level. But just... as a person, he really is very sweet.
Yeah, yeah. Some of the book deals with your reaction to having been the only Jewish student in your circle in high school, and basically in that entire community. I mean, I don't think you had more than a couple other people in your school who were Jewish. And having to experience sort of in this sort of solitary state all the mentions of Jews in literature, many of which seemed unattractive or unkind. You mentioned that in The Sun Also Rises, Jake says of Cohn, he had a hard Jewish stubborn streak.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think other people looked at you in these moments as the representative Jew, or do you think that that was mostly something you were putting on yourself?
Well, the interesting thing is that at the time, I thought that, yeah, everybody saw me as just, you know, this other Jewish and, you know, but I made friends and I, you know, sort of tried to overcome all of that. But I think ultimately I was seen sort of as other. What's ironic is that thanks to Facebook, I'm now in touch with quite a few people from my high school, and they didn't see me that way at all.
Isn't that funny?
They really, like, one woman in particular, who I didn't even know her that well in high school, she said, I always looked up to you, and I always thought you were so beautiful and just different looking. And of course, I felt like, yes, I was different looking, but I didn't want to look Jewish, I wanted to look Christian. I mean, it's just bizarre how we see ourselves. I mean, which, and a lot of that is just typical high school stuff.
Absolutely.
Because I think everybody struggles in junior high and high school and wants to be perfect and look like everybody else and not be different, and everybody's having the same struggle.
Right.
But nobody can really talk about it because we're too young to sort of know how to approach that. So it's really, it's been eye-opening to meet these people now on Facebook to think that they like me. Like,
Sally Fields.
I know they like me. I want to go back now and do it all over again.
Like Robin Hemley did.
I know, exactly.
Yeah. Speaking of feeling like an outsider or you didn't fit, I love the information that you've shared about Natalie Wood. And I'm not going to read it because I don't know how to pronounce her birth name. But this is so interesting. She was born Russian.
Yeah, she's
in San Francisco.
Exactly.
And then she's playing a Puerto Rican woman
in West Side Story
who wants to be white, basically.
Yeah.
Or who wants to fall in love with the white boy.
Right.
I loved that. And then you said that at her funeral they played Russian string music.
Right.
Which was never anything it sounded like she ever really identified with either.
No, I know.
It's so interesting.
I know. I just started doing some research on her, and I just found this wealth of information, which totally fit in. I mean, these are like gifts when you're writing a book.
Absolutely.
And then you find these details that totally sort of fit your message.
Yeah.
And you can use, because, you know, Natalie Wood, you know, as a movie star back then, you know, of course I wanted to be her too. I mean, and to find out that we weren't so dissimilar.
Yeah, yeah. So
except she, of course, was famous. And
except she was Natalie Wood.
Yeah, right. I was not, other than that.
So I once attended a lecture that you gave about windows in literature and noticing the way we use windows in our work. And in this book, you have a great window moment, probably more than one, but I remember this one, and I wonder if you mind if I read it.
Sure.
Is that okay?
Yes.
So you're in English class. I watch the backs of Christopher's wrists through lowered lashes. The winter sun slanting through the row of rectangular windows casts the wispy hairs in platinum light. Last autumn, the sun tinged them a reddish yellow. By June, I know I'll still be spying on him. After weeks of baseball, they'll deepen to gold. I rest my chin in my palm, canting toward him, inhaling his scent of ivory soap and juicy fruit, gum. The overlap of his front teeth, this one small flaw, makes me want to kiss him, though he's never even held my hand. I, with my darkness, feel almost inchoate at the presence of such incandescence. So I loved that paragraph, and it reminded me of your talk about windows, and I wondered if you could talk about your use of windows or your thoughts about using windows in literature.
Sure. I think that, particularly in creative nonfiction, the idea of whether you have a physical window or just write sort of with the idea of it, but that, you know, a lot of memoirs are labeled narcissistic and navel gazers and everything. And I take deep exception to that because we're not. And the reason why I take exception to that, because if you're writing, you know, literary memoir, literary creative nonfiction, you are writing as if the self is superimposed on a window, that there's a whole world out there, and that your message is much more universal. So it's looking at out of a window as opposed to staring into a mirror.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, say the memoirs that fail, or the ones that just critics want to attack for the sake of attacking, they, you know, label them narcissistic. And it's true that if the author is just sort of writing about the self as if looking into a mirror, so that all you really can see is yourself, then there is a kind of narcissistic bent to it. But if you introduce the idea of a window and this whole outer world and sort of the interplay between the self and the world that's seen through the window, then there is a kind of energy between self and world. And then the metaphors that one discovers by looking out of the window do make the work, you know, rather universal.
Right.
So it wasn't anything that I do consciously.
Right.
It's
right.
Just that unconsciously, I think that I do write with a sense of a kind of universe out there, and that I'm trying to find my self-exploration, my search for identity, is layered over, you know, these sort of larger issues, say like religion and identity with this world out there that can sometimes offer you pieces of your identity, but it's a way to kind of search for your identity by sort of looking out the window. There's a place to go to kind of see the self.
Right. And you said something earlier about how you hadn't really thought about how Pat Boone, you know, was this ultimate father figure to you until you started writing about it and looking at it maybe through this different perspective, and looking out these windows maybe helps us see our story in a different way.
Exactly. I mean, if I had just written about Pat Boone, say, looking into a mirror, then he would just always only be Pat Boone, the movie star, pop singer.
Yeah.
But by being able to kind of see him within this more world view, which would be one of looking out of a window, then I'm able to discover these other aspects of him, that he is this really kind, gentle, sort of caring man.
Mm.
And that's sort of the portal into which I can sort of enter that material.
Right.
As if I am writing about him, looking at him, religion, and all that represents, as if looking out of a window.
Right. And in fact, I think that the excerpt that I chose to read is beautiful, but it doesn't, in fact, talk directly about what you're talking about, because you're not looking out the window. You're using the light coming through the window to light something that you're looking at, but
right.
Still.
It's sort of, no, it is the same idea, because yeah. It's just that what the window can introduce into a scene is really sort of what I'm getting at. In the part that you read, the light is coming through the window. So that does introduce this idea of this whole world out there that can enter me and enter the scene,
yeah.
So that I'm not just trapped in this kind of very sort of narcissistic place in terms of being trapped in the self, but that the world is introduced. So the window is a two-way street,
yeah,
in that
sense. It's
about
movement, too, in a way. Yeah.
Exactly.
Okay, great, thanks. I love the chapter that you titled The Wandering Jew, which has to do with a homeless man, a tramp, who you noticed and became very focused on as a child living in St. Thomas. And he would walk the streets striking a musical triangle, and he didn't really speak or stop or interact with people. And you were fascinated by him, and I thought that was really interesting for a few reasons. I think I've heard from other people their stories of having noticed adults who were perhaps mentally ill or childlike or vulnerable in some way when they were children. And this, to me, really spoke, because I felt like, yeah, you know, when we're children, we see these people and we're very curious about them. So I loved this chapter. So I wonder if you can talk a little bit about that and about including the essay in the book.
Sure. And that is one essay that had been a standalone, and it was more sort of focused on the tramp and just the hypocrisy. This took place in the West Indies, and the hypocrisy between sort of the white people who lived there, who, you know, like with me, my father's molesting me, a lot of my friends, their parents were alcoholics. I mean, they presented this perfect picture,
mm-hmm.
but it was so hypocritical, because behind closed doors they were abusing their children, hurting them, and then this
your friend Vicky, right?
Exactly,
right.
Her father beat her, And then this tramp represented a kind of, who was of the islands, who was a West Indian, and he represented a kind of purity. He sort of lived in nature. So he represented a very pure image to me, a kind of a metaphor for purity. And by focusing on that, he became a kind of savior persona. So in that sense, he's a metaphor in the same way that Pat Boone is a metaphor. Even though he's a homeless tramp and Pat Boone is this movie star, in a way they serve the same purpose in terms of the book, in that this homeless tramp, given this sort of, he's untouched by sort of hypocritical white people. He's untouched by things or money or ownership. I mean, he's just this person who he can just live in nature, mm-hmm. and he doesn't need all of the trappings. And so, to me, that's almost like a Christ-like persona, and a kind of, I never met him, I never did speak to him, nor did I need to. I just needed to know he existed and that I could follow him, and sort of felt safe just following him at a distance, that knowing that he wasn't going to hurt me. Mm-hmm. And that, so he becomes a sort of savior persona in the book.
It's interesting because it's clear that when you were a kid, you were very curious, and that curiosity sort of saved you in a lot of different ways and times.
Oh, it did. I mean, because, you know, when you're living in an incestuous family and you don't think that there's a way out, it is a matter of sort of finding these windows and what's outside those windows as ways to hold on to a sense of reality and a sense of self, and to know that there are there's a larger meaning out there, so that even though the tramp and Pat Boone are very different, they serve the same purpose in that I could sort of fixate on them and know that there was something else out there. And as a kid, I didn't know, of course, I didn't have the language to understand any of that. And in fact, I did not have the language to understand until really I started writing about it. And that's when I came to understand that, oh, Pat Boone was this father figure, this tramp was this a savior, which we also can sort of think of as a father figure. Mm-hmm. And so by writing about them, I was able to understand the significant role that they played in my life, and I also latched onto the other tramp, Charlie Chaplin, mm-hmm. in that chapter as well.
Right.
And I was fixated on Charlie Chaplin for years. In fact, I'm still sort of fixated on him. But because the tramp also, in terms of the book, sort of saved young girls. And so I just would fixate on these people and or events that seemed safe and that could sort of keep me alive until I sort of found out how to sort of save myself.
Yeah. They sort of promised hope or escape, yeah, or
absolutely.
Other.
Exactly.
Another
all
life.
Of that.
Yeah.
All
yeah.
of that.
Interesting.
Faith, hope, meaning, mm-hmm. metaphor. And again, I couldn't have put any of that into words at the time. I didn't need to. Just knowing that they existed, mm-hmm. was what kept me alive in many ways.
Speaking of being alive and almost not, you write about your experience with an illness that you had, C. diff.
C. difficile.
C. difficile. From which you became very, very ill, and people have died from this. It took a long time for them to diagnose the illness and help you treat it. And you suffered long-term consequences, including losing a great deal of weight, some of which you never were able to put back on. So I have two questions about this. First of all, how soon after you were better did you write this, or were you able to write about it while you were experiencing it?
No, I did not write about it while I was experiencing it. I wrote about it probably about 2 years afterwards.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. So this, to me, is an example of writing about a personal experience where you, as the author, felt wronged because the medical system really failed you.
Yes.
You've written about other experiences of having been wronged, such as you mentioned, your father's sexual abuse when you were a child. And I'm wondering what advice you have for writers of memoir, I think probably more specifically, or poetry, or people who are writing about their own experiences, about writing from a place of abuse or victimization or mistreatment. How would you suggest that writers approach these subjects? I guess I'll just leave it at that. How? Yeah.
Well, I think that it's important to tell our truths. And even if we're going to upset other people, that's not my job to even worry about that. Mm-hmm. I see my job as a writer is not to make people feel comfortable. It really is to tell, look, this is my truth, and I own my stories, and I can write about them. And I can't say I don't care if I upset people, because I do. I mean, I feel badly, I guess, if I upset people, but not enough to stop me from writing about it. I mean, I just have to, if there's an event or anything that happens to me that I have to figure out and make sense of, I'm going to write about it. And I just feel that's really crucial, because if we don't tell our stories, nobody's going to tell our stories. And as writers, that's all we have. Really, regardless of whether you tell it as fiction or poetry or creative nonfiction, they're still our stories. Mm. And the goal of an artist is to be heard, is for our voices to be out there.
Right.
And so I just think it's imperative for us to tell our stories.
One addendum to my question is, or a comment, is I never get a sense of your writing out of a motivation of revenge in any way. So I wonder if you can just address that.
That's absolutely true. I absolutely, in fact, I'm usually harder on myself than anybody else, because I don't think writing out of a place of revenge will help us understand what that episode meant or what our journey means.
Yeah.
It's really just like kind of payback. I write from a point of wanting to understand what something meant to me, and how does that fit into my whole life, and what are the metaphors of the experience. That's why I write anything. And so it's not to get back at anybody or to overtly try to make somebody feel bad or anything. I don't. I mean, I really write to understand my own experience, and I strongly encourage other writers of memoir to not think about it in terms of revenge either, because I don't think that that is what memoir is about at all.
Mm.
It really is about telling our truths and understanding them and kind of giving an organization and structure to our lives that we wouldn't just see in the living of life. You know, I mean, writing a memoir is taking a life and turning it into art.
Mm-hmm.
It's not Xeroxing a life. In real life, do I feel, I hate that doctor who gave me those antibiotics that made me sick. I mean, just seriously ill. I mean, I really despise her. But I don't have to write about that, because I know that to be true. And so what was more important to me is to understand what that disease meant, and how life is so fragile, and how just through no fault of my own, all of a sudden I was given antibiotics for an illness I didn't even have.
Right.
And but at the same time, oh gosh, this is so weird, but yes, I regret ever having that C. difficile infection, because it was so awful. But it really fits the book so well, because when I went to see Pat Boone, I was still just recovering. And it was a kind of like when he hugged me, it was a laying on of hands to cure me. I mean, it so fit with the theme of the book that I was happy to have that. But at the same
time, to write about.
I was not, in real life, I was not happy to have the C. difficile infection. But in terms of writing the book, I can't, it helped the book.
Yeah.
I mean, so it's a very odd place to be.
Well, it is funny, though, isn't it?
It is.
Because writing becomes more than just a way of working through your truth, although
know.
You hope that's what it does.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's fine. Well, Sue, those are all my questions. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate your interest in my book. Thank you.
That, once again, was a conversation with Sue William Silverman. You can learn more about her work at SueWilliamSilverman.com. Write the Book and the Radiator are supported in part by HelloVT.com, bringing communities together with Vermont news, videos, and local events. Visit HelloVT at HelloVT.com. Today's Write the Book prompt was suggested by my second guest on today's show, Sue William Silverman, who does have a book on craft called Fearless Confessions. She says, it can be interesting to get a photograph of yourself from another period in your life, such as when you were a kid, and write a paragraph that describes what you see in the photograph. Then write another paragraph about what was happening outside the frame of the photograph. For example, Sue said she looks at a lot of photographs of herself as a kid in which she is smiling and looks really happy. Nobody would know that she was, as she put it, dying inside at that time in her life. So she might write the first paragraph about the pretty young girl who is beaming from ear to ear, but then she might write a second paragraph about what's not taking place in the picture, which for Sue would, of course, be to write about growing up in this incestuous family, and even possibly exploring the idea that her father might have been taking that photograph and he was maybe forcing her to smile to convey the idea that theirs was a happy family. Sue says this can be an interesting exercise in comparing and contrasting what else might be going on. You have a picture, and that's great, but is it telling the truth, or is there another truth happening just outside the frame? Good luck with this exercise, and please do listen next week for another. If you're interested in sharing this show with out-of-town friends, let them know they can stream it live at theradiator.org every Monday from 2 to 3 p.m. Archived episodes of Write the Book are also available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. You can visit Write the Book on Twitter and Write the Book Radio Show on Facebook for updates. You can also access the show from my own website, shelaughswithoutus.com. And I have a personal request. If you do go on iTunes at all to access the podcast, I would totally appreciate it if you would give a review of the show on iTunes or on the podcast site, writethebook.podbean.com. Please remember that this station is here thanks to community support and involvement. More information about The Radiator is available online at theradiator.org. This has been Write the Book. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and you're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMMLP, Burlington, Vermont.